And yeah, it's really good to be here at Sangha Night. Since I arrived in Cambridge, I haven't been able to come to Sangha Night very often because we have our community night on a Tuesday evening. But that's changed now, so I will be able to come to Sangha Night a bit more often, which I'm looking forward to. Yeah. And yes, it's very nice for Ratnagosha to say the things that he said. But I have to say, when I really started thinking about this talk, I was thinking, actually, the mind precepts, they're quite challenging. And I'm just new to this. My talk is going to be quite a personal talk, actually. Just explaining, trying to explain how it is that I've become so interested in and enthusiastic about the precepts, about Buddhist ethics generally, and in particular the mind precepts. But I definitely feel like I'm still something of a beginner with the mind precepts in particular. So with the eighth precept, we come to the first of the mind precepts. So we've got three kind of precepts of the body and four precepts of speech. And then the final three precepts are to do with the mind. And I was reflecting that on this today. I was thinking, actually, these are the precepts that distinguish Buddhism. You know, this is what makes Buddhist ethics Buddhist, is practicing the precepts of mind. And they're quite an extraordinary gift, actually, from the Buddha to us. They are definitely the gateway to freedom. Well, I say definitely, I haven't quite got there, but I believe that they are the gateway to freedom. And we have to sort of accept and practice the body precepts and the speech precepts. But the real work, I believe, is the mind precepts. And I've been thinking about this talk all day, and actually for quite a while, and I don't know, I just somehow am a bit worried it's going to be very short. It's quite difficult to speak about this because it's very mysterious. You know, the mind is very mysterious. And how we come into relationship with our minds is really to do with intuition and experience that is kind of almost beyond words, actually. But anyway, I'll try to communicate something this evening and let's see what happens. I have made some notes. Yes, and I think I will begin by just talking a little bit about how it was that I became a Buddhist and how ethics became an important part of my sort of practice. Because I wasn't drawn to ethics of any kind in particular, actually, when I first encountered Buddhism. And my first encounter with Buddhism really was Tree Ratna Buddhism. I went to a meditation class at the London Buddhist Centre in 2003, probably about this time of year, 2003. I went for a meditation class at the London Buddhist Centre. And I think what I was looking for then was to change myself. I'd actually been involved for quite a few years with the 12-step program, and not for alcoholics, but for friends and family of alcoholics. And the one really important thing that I learned in that situation was that all of everything that was difficult in my experience was my responsibility, and that I had never understood that. That I'd always thought that what was difficult was out there, and it had to change. And it slowly dawned on me around this time, around the year 2000 and so, that, oh no, it's me. It's me! It's the way I'm looking at the world, it's the way I'm seeing myself. That is the problem. And I think I became aware that unless I really got a handle on this, I was going to get into quite deep trouble. I mean, I was already in a fair amount of trouble, actually, but I was going to, it was not going to get any better. So somebody told me about these meditation classes at the LBC, and thought, well, that sounds quite interesting. I'll go along and see what happens. I can learn to meditate. So I kind of was looking for kind of what a lot of people are looking for, to reduce my suffering, to reduce my stress, to get into better contact with myself and to find a focus in a way. I was very lucky that my first meditation teacher was Jnanavacha. You probably have come across him. And I was so deeply impressed with Jnanavacha and the meditation classes at the LBC that I just very, very quickly decided that as long as I went there once a week or so, something good was going to happen. And that was when I sort of picked up the thread, really, of my Buddhist practice. And it's kind of unbroken, really, since then. So as I say, I wasn't interested in ethics particularly. In fact, I was quite an enthusiastic eater of meat, and I enjoyed a drink, and I smoked, and I was quite sort of wild, actually. And I didn't really want to give up any of those things, particularly, well, cigarettes. I did want to give up cigarettes, but I certainly didn't want to stop eating meat. I identified quite strongly as a meat eater. I spent a lot of time rationalising eating meat. So I accepted the first precept, but I thought, you can't live on this planet without harming creatures. If I eat free-range organic meat, that's enough. So that's what I decided to do. And that lasted for quite a long time. The first thing that I really noticed with meditation and ethics was that as I got deeper into my meditation practice, and I enjoyed meditation, and I found it very sort of satisfying and interesting, but I did notice that if I was disturbed about something, then that would have an impact on my meditation. And the first things that really started to make themselves felt for me was the way that I related to people. So I began to understand dimly that I had the habit of clinging to people that I loved for dear life and being pretty horrible to people that I didn't respect or that I didn't like, and being quite arrogant, dismissive, judgmental. And I began to understand that that wasn't very good. It wasn't helpful for me, it wasn't compassionate, it wasn't realistic, and it was kind of quite damaging, actually. So that was when I started to understand that if I wanted to go deeper in my meditation practice, I had to start behaving differently, quite fundamentally differently, and I had to take the precepts much more seriously. The other thing that was quite a strong aspect of my experience was romance. I had a capacity for falling madly in love with the wrong person and being quite obsessive about it, quite driven. And it was very much like a sort of boom and bust economy. So I would be fabulously in love and inspired and, you know, writing poetry, writing songs, dreaming and feeling amazing, and then I would just go right down into the depths of despair and abandonment and self-hatred. And I thought you couldn't have the one without the other. For me, I sort of accepted the darkness. It was all part of my romantic persona kind of thing. But again, gradually I sort of began to realise that this was self-harming in a way, and also it was damaging to the other person, to the other people involved. And I sort of realised it was an addiction. It was an addiction. And that it wasn't going to be that easy to overcome it. So I needed some strong tools and some, I needed to work hard. So, yeah. In fact, one of the things that I did, I've just realised I've done it this evening as well, is like my favourite colours used to be sort of pink and brown and red and sort of fiery colours, kind of sensual colours, warm colours. And I sort of realised that I was burning. I was burning and that I wanted to cool down. So one of the things that I did was I just started wearing blue and green just to sort of help myself to start to cool down. And, you know, the Buddha does kind of characterise craving as being kind of a burning, and nirvana is a kind of quenching of these flames. So I began to, like, my romantic persona found that very unattractive, but I began to think maybe there's something in this coolness that is to be sort of moved towards. So yeah, one of the things that I did was start wearing blue. And in my first year of going to the LBC, 2004 was the year of Akshobhya. They started a cycle where they would spend a year with Akshobhya, who's the Buddha of the East, the first of the five jhanas. And then the following year it was, what would it have been the following year? Ratnasambhava. And so we went around the whole kind of, over those 5 years, we went around the whole kind of mandala of the five Buddhas, which I kind of think it's really fortunate that I sort of stepped in just as Akshobhya sort of. And I really connected to the cool blueness of Akshobhya and the antidote to hatred and the mirror-like wisdom. It was just what I needed. It just kind of helped to quench my fire in a way. And I really sort of embraced Akshobhya. And a little bit further along the line, Padmasambhava became a very important figure for me. So, in a way, he represented this kind of romantic, he represented a sort of a sublimation, if you like, of the romantic figure that I would fall for, the man who was going to save me. I sort of thought, well, maybe Padmasambhava could become that for me, because he's kind of safe. He's not real, for one thing. But he's transcendent, you know, so he's got there's a wisdom in him that I'm never going to find in a mortal male. And even if it was there, I wouldn't recognise it. Do you see what I mean? So Padmasambhava became and has continued to be a very important sort of figure for me. And definitely, I have learned a huge amount from Padmasambhava. But there have been times when I've just quite simply had to prostrate myself and said, you know, asked him to sort of take over because I'm not able to function. I hope I'm not coming across as a complete lunatic.
You like lunatics.
Yeah, so I first went to the LBC in 2003, and I got really stuck in quite quickly, and I became a Mitra in 2004, and I became joined the evolution team. It must have been 2005, January 2005, that I joined a shop team and became, you know, fully involved in team-based right livelihood, and I moved into community at the same time, more or less. And then in 2006, I asked for ordination. But I didn't actually get ordained until 2016. So I had, what is that, something like 12 years of practicing the five precepts, and I needed every one of those 12 years. to begin to get the hang of it, So I've only had, you know, basically I'm two, as an order member, I'm 2 years old, and I've only had 2 years to practice, you know, fully engage with the ten precepts. So, you know, these are notes from someone who's like an apprentice. But I kind of, yeah, I did get there. I have definitely cooled down. I'm definitely much more stable. I'm much happier. My energy is more consistently available to me. And I'm a very happy order member. I'm really, really happy. I enjoyed my ordination retreat enormously. I'm so glad that I was kind of that ready when I went to get ordained, when I went on my ordination retreat, because the 3 months was just, you know, easy for me. And it isn't always easy. I mean, I was really lucky that I'd had years of experience of community life and team-based right livelihood, and I'd been through all sorts of very difficult experiences, actually, within the Sangha as well as outside of the Sangha. And, you know, that's what formed me. Basically, it's quite hard work. Working on yourself, transforming yourself, is quite hard work. But I just want to say that it's kind of worth it. and this... Now I'm going to sort of slightly change the subject. Or change direction a little bit. I was on retreat recently. I was on a 10-day retreat recently in Vajraloka, and it was great. There was about 8 or 9 days of silence, and I took a novel with me. I took Jane Austen's Sense and Sensibility. I don't know if any, which you're not supposed to do on retreat, and I'm not saying you should do that really, but anyway, I did on this occasion. I don't know how many people have read Jane Austen. How many people have read Jane Austen? We've got any big Jane Austen fans here? Okay, so about half and half. I remember telling my therapist, actually, I had a therapist a few years ago who was an order member, and I said, I said something about Jane Austen, and he laughed. He thought Jane Austen was something very, very trivial. And, for me, I love her novels. I've always loved her novels. My grandmother used to read them to me when I was ill in bed. And they seem like a safe place. But recently I was thinking, I wonder if there's something about the mind precepts, actually, in Jane Austen. I wonder if, in a way, her novels are sort of deeply ethical and concerned with what you might call, in a way, something like the mind precepts. So I wanted to explore that. So I just came across a second-hand edition of Sense and Sensibility in Cambridge. Cambridge is brilliant for second-hand bookshops. They're sort of drying up in other parts of the country, but not in Cambridge. So I took it and I started reading it. And I think there's something in my theory, actually. The very title of the novel, actually, when you think about it, it's a very, very interesting sort of title, Sense and Sensibility. And in a way, it's a novel about a kind of battle between sense and sensibility. So, sense, I looked it up in the dictionary today, so I'm just going to see what it said in the dictionary about sense. Well, one meaning of the word sense is a faculty by which the body perceives an external stimulus. One of the faculties of sight, smell, hearing, taste, and touch. So sense, faculty of sense. Of course, in Buddhism, we've got a sixth sense, the mind. Another meaning of the word sense is a feeling that something is the case. A feeling that something is the case. So I get the sense that you are still all listening to me. I get the sense that you're still listening to me. It's quite interesting because how I have that sense is quite mysterious. But let's not get too diverted. Another meaning of the word sense is a sane and realistic attitude to situations and problems. A sane and realistic attitude to situations and problems. A reasonable or comprehensible rationale. Sense. As opposed to sensibility. So the meaning of sensibility is, well, there are two meanings. The quality of being able to appreciate and respond to complex emotional or aesthetic influences. The quality of being able to appreciate and respond to complex emotional and aesthetic influences. So sensibility is being able to look at a picture and see its qualities, or look at a landscape and know what's beautiful about it. And it's a responsiveness to beauty. But there's a second meaning for sensibility, which is a quality of delicate sensitivity that makes one liable to be shocked or offended. So sensibility can be quite a negative thing in that sense, in that one can be overwhelmed by a beautiful picture, one can be sort of taken over by it, or one can be sort of overwhelmed by a landscape, or one can be offended by something that somebody else says, and that just, you know, sends you home to bed for the day or something. This novel, Sense and Sensibility, is about two sisters. One sister is Sense, and the other sister is Sensibility. Eleanor is a cool, rational, sensible person, and her sister, Marianne, is a romantic, a bit like what I used to be, probably still am in some respects. It's very, very interesting. If you read that novel, you'll see how Marianne really identifies so strongly with, you know, the landscape, pictures have to be, you know, very romantic. Men have to have capes and be striding across the hills, and they have to have a dog and a horse, and they must be, you know, romantic heroes. Whereas Eleanor, her elder sister, is much cooler, much more sort of rational. And the novel sort of plays out the relationship between these two sisters. I think, you know, when I used to read that novel, I thought Eleanor was a bit boring. And I had quite a lot of sympathy with Marianne, the romantic one. But the thing is, Marianne gets herself into very deep trouble to the point where she almost dies. She's abandoned by her romantic hero, and she almost dies as a consequence of a broken heart, which is actually quite possible. I know we think it's a bit... I think it is possible to die of a broken heart. If you want to, you can. Eleanor, meanwhile, she has this sense. She understands, and she knows that everything that she says, everything that she writes, everything that she thinks is ethically potent. And she acts accordingly. So she's in love with this man called Edward Ferrars, played by Hugh Grant in the film. And he has made a mistake in the past. And he's secretly engaged to a young flibbertigibbet of a woman who is worthless by any standards. But he's very noble, so he's going to stand by this woman. And when Eleanor, the sensible sister, finds this out, she behaves with... what's the word? She's very, very ethical in the way that she doesn't act out. She doesn't cling. She doesn't sulk. She maintains faith in her feeling of love, and she knows that to say the wrong thing, or to sort of cling, or to try and manipulate the situation, although it might get her what she wants, it's not going to have a beneficial outcome in terms of freedom of heart. So I'm not going to go into a great deal of detail about how that plays itself out in the novel. If you're interested, you could read it and see. But she is a very strong example of speech and mind precepts at work, I would say. And in the end, she gets her man. But it's not really about getting your man. It's about being free. It's about being spiritually and emotionally and sort of in the mind free, not clinging to the other, not clinging to what you think you deserve, just keeping faith, actually, keeping faith, and actually not acting, renouncing the idea that you deserve something and therefore it doesn't matter what you do to get it. Which, let's face it, even to this day, we're much more kind of relaxed these days than we were in Jane Austen's time. But we still think that it's all's fair in love and war, don't we? We tend to think that, you know, to get our man, we're kind of able to do anything, really. And I think that, Jane Austen explores the ethics of that very, very interestingly. But I wasn't really able to see that really before. I did used to teach English literature in the university, and I don't think I even spotted that particularly before. I mean, I don't think I was top class academic, don't get me wrong. I'm sure there are plenty of academics who do see that very well. So, that was a little bit of a diversion, but I thought it was quite an interesting illustration, and I like the contrast between the notion of sense and sensibility. I think that expresses something about the mind that it's really helpful for us to reflect on for ourselves. What kind of heats us up and what cools us down? So coming back to the eighth precept and the mind precepts generally. I think there's a good verse in the Dhammapada which illustrates the importance of working with craving. Whoever in the world overcomes this wretched, adhesive craving, so difficult to overcome, his sorrows will fall from him like water from the lotus leaf. So I think Eleanor in Sense and Sensibility expresses that, something of that. Whoever in the world overcomes this wretched, adhesive craving, so difficult to overcome, her sorrows will fall from her like water from the lotus leaf. So when we're practicing the mind precepts, we are actually becoming proficient in right mindfulness. We use our awareness, and we practice in meditation to notice where it is that we're clinging, where it is that we're holding on, what it is that we're clinging to, that we don't want to let go of. We notice that, and we just notice how it feels to cling to it. That's all, actually. Like, in a way, it's very hard, but in a way, it's very simple. And it doesn't require a great deal of effort. What it really requires is setting up the conditions so that you can do it. And those conditions could be summed up as from my perspective anyway, as the three jewels. Sangha, you need people to support you on the path. Dharma, you need wisdom, insight. And Buddha, the mythic aspect, I would say in this context. So Akshobhya or Padmasambhava. These figures help you to be more than you think you are. They inspire you to do more than you think you can do. And it's actually these moments of craving are amazingly difficult to overcome. So, like, for example, when I was on that retreat last week, a couple of weeks ago, at breakfast time, there's about how many of us on the retreat? I don't know, I hope I'm not going on too long. About 20 bowls, those little bowls like we've got in the kitchen here, tiny little bowls. Who wants to eat their porridge out of a bowl like that? And then there are two beautiful, big bowls, and they're blue. They're a really nice shade of blue. And I'm thinking, well, that's my bowl. That's my bowl. That breakfast bowl is my bowl. And so I get to the front of the queue at breakfast time, and I nab that bowl to have my porridge in. The porridge isn't going to taste any good in a funny little white bowl. And I sort of noticed, after about day three, that there's about three of us hovering around the room. We've all got this idea that somehow that is my bowl, and that my day is going to be ruined if I don't have that bowl. So obviously I noticed it and I worked with it. It was a renunciation to eat. Once I'd decided that this little bowl was just pathetic, to eat porridge out of it was a renunciation. It was genuinely a renunciation. And I did it. And of course, it's nothing like as bad as you think it's going to be. But it's surprisingly difficult to let go of the blue bowl. Strange, isn't it? But that's what we're doing. That's what we're doing when we're that is what we're doing when we're working with the mind precepts, basically. Is we're noticing where we're clinging on, and then we're kind of moving in the other direction, gently and kindly. Just before I got ordained, I went on the ethics retreat. I put it off until pretty much the last moment. So I went on the ethics retreat at Tiruvannamalai in March 2015. I left it to the very last moment. And I was very moved by that retreat. I was moved by the beauty of the mind precepts. And I noticed today that I'd written something to my cooler just after that retreat about why I wanted to get ordained. And I thought, I'll read it to you this evening, just to remind, just because in a way it puts it out there. So this is what I wrote. To become an order member means for me undertaking to follow the heart, to honour my heart's longing for freedom, and as much as possible to enable other people to do the same. To trust and give license to the intuitive self. To remind myself always to be present and connected to my environment and the people around me. To treat my body and the bodies of all sentient beings with respect. To recognize that it is an instrument of salvation. The locus of memory, desire, and understanding. What it knows and what it means is actually beyond my ken, but still, it is properly my responsibility. So to trust and give license to the intuitive self is only really possible if you've got a strong ethical sort of framework. Otherwise, the intuitive self is just going to fall flat on its face, basically. So we need that strong intuitive, that strong ethical basis, a real understanding and connection with the precepts, the mind precepts in particular, in order to let the intuitive self express itself appropriately. And obviously, it was on my ordination retreat where I received my name, Vidya Sakhi. And while I was putting this talk together, I thought, actually, Vidya and sensibility are very closely related. So Vidya means a sort of an aesthetic appreciation, a pure awareness. So in that sense, it has a very sort of close connection to the idea of sensibility. And of course, in order for that to be safe and strong, it needs this ethical context. It needs this recognition of the importance of coolness. And that's, I suppose, my preceptor must have seen this. And she gave me the other part of my name, Sakhi. And Sakhi means friend, a witness. And friendship that is cool rather than hot. Friendship that is not about a passionate clinging or any kind of romance. It's a friendship which is alongside the other and wishes the best for the other. Sees deeply into the other, but doesn't sort of meddle. So thank you to my preceptor for my name. I'm really grateful for it. Vandana Jyoti, that was. And just one more thing I'll say. I've said that for me, mind precepts are, they're kind of like poetry. And what I mean is, I was thinking about Seamus Heaney, who's possibly my favourite poet. And I think he, one of the things that I think is really very, very interesting about Seamus Heaney is that he's sort of lived between these two worlds of kind of England and Ireland. I mean, he's Northern Irish and he lived through a very, very polarised time, and he managed to walk between the two sides of that pole with incredible integrity. And he explains, I think, how he manages to do that in an essay that he wrote called The Redress of Poetry. And for him, poetry is something which goes against the grain of the usual. It goes against the grain of the usual. It adds weight to the lighter scale. So if you're sure that you're right about something, you're wrong. He also says that obedience to the laws of gravity is the greatest sin. And that makes me think of what Bhante says in Living with Kindness, which is that when we practice metta, we're going against the gravitational pull of the self. And that's what we're doing when we're mindfully noticing our clinging and just kind of letting go, just releasing, just going beyond our personal desires. I think that's probably it.